Listen, anyway, what are you doing this weekend, Albie?
I'm going to Birmingham for Tory conference.
Oh, so of course.
Maybe there'll be some more speed
I gas. Have some recommendations for you where to eat and drink there, Albie. And what about you, Zoe?
I am not going to Tory conference. I'm going to Spain for my friend's wedding.
You win.
I win.
You win. Absolutely. Well, actually, no. Birmingham's just as good. But I know what you mean. It's just coming up to midday.
Voice of the UK. And the home of the Premier League. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The 5 Live News with Dina Campbell. Two 13-year-old boys will serve a minimum of 8 years and 6 months in prison for the murder of Sean Sisahai with a machete. They were both aged just 12 years old when they killed 19-year-old Mr. Sisahai in Wolverhampton last year, making them the youngest convicted murderers since the killing of James Bulger. The BBC has learned that the General Medical Council, which regulates doctors in the UK, refused in 2017 to investigate alleged medical malpractice at Harrods. A complaint was made by a woman who underwent an intimate examination while applying for a job at the department store in 2008, when it was owned by Mohammed Al-Fayed. The GMC says it will carefully assess any new complaints. Mohammed Al-Fayed, who died last year, is facing accusations of rape and sexual assault. Our correspondent Tom Simons reports.
The job applicant in her 20s was given intimate medical tests while applying to work at Harrods in 2008. She had an infection. A doctor said it would be kept confidential. But she told the BBC the same day Mohammed Al-Fayed asked if she had got that thing taken care of and picked up a prescription. She complained in 2017 to the General Medical Council that he'd been given her private medical information. But the GMC said it couldn't act. There was a 5-year time limit on launching investigations, and it wasn't in the greater public interest to waive this rule.
A major review of the way police forces deal with reports of stalking has called for significant changes. The report, written by the Independent Office for Police Conduct, Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary and the College of Policing, warned many victims weren't being protected. It found officers lacked understanding of the scale and types of stalking. Rachel Watson is from the IOPC.
We're finding, unfortunately, that victims are not receiving the service that they should consistently. In many cases, investigations inconsistent and they're not being believed.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is expected to address the United Nations General Assembly in New York this afternoon as he faces international pressure to agree to a ceasefire with Hezbollah in Lebanon. Sir Keir Starmer, who was also at the session but has since returned to the UK, told world leaders there should be an immediate pause in the fighting to allow for diplomacy. The UK has asked commercial airlines to lay on extra flights out of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, to allow British nationals to leave because of the fighting between Hezbollah and Israel. It's estimated that there are currently several hundred people with British passports in the country and 5,000 dual nationals. Time for sport now with Mike McCarthy.
Well, they're supposed to be playing in less than half an hour at Lord's, where England must win the fourth one-day international against Australia to keep the series alive. But at the moment, the covers are on and the toss has been delayed. The draw for the Women's Champions League takes place shortly, with Chelsea, Arsenal, Manchester City and Celtic set to discover their group stage opponents. We'll keep you across that. In the Premier League, Liverpool keeper Alisson expected to return for tomorrow's trip to Wolves, but injured Newcastle striker Alexander Isak expected to miss their clash with Manchester City. And tributes are being paid to snooker commentator Clive Everton, who's died at the age of 87. He covered the sport for the BBC for more than 30 years. Former world champion Sean Murphy called him snooker broadcasting royalty.
Football on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Listen to exclusive live commentaries from the Premier League, Champions League and more with the 5 Live sport team.
He's been on the pitch for 10 seconds. Thank you very much.
Top of everything football every day with the Football Daily Podcast.
This is the best central defensive partnership in European football.
His confidence levels are through the roof.
Football on 5 Live.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
Childs on Friday. Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's just gone 4 minutes past 12, so I wish you a very good Friday afternoon. The weekend is upon us. Coming up a little bit later, we're going to have Colin Hendry will join me and Kate Mason as we talk about the weekend's football. And we've got We got the great golfer Padraig Harrington coming on, just because I saw a clip of him on Twitter on the PGA page, I think, and I mean, somebody who gave up golf because it was making me just too miserable. I've been through a lot of tips. I've tried tips from people over the years, and it works for a while or doesn't work at all. That's a truly radical one from the great Padraig Harrington. And sorry if I've lost you if you don't play golf. But in this clip, he suggests actually, instead of planting your feet when you take the shot, actually with your front foot, your left foot, obviously you're right-handed, obviously, taking a step with it, before you address them, but just almost as you're on the backswing, you take a step forward and then strike the ball. Extraordinary stuff. I mean, and Padraig's very kindly agreed to come on and talk about it. I know John Robbins is really into his golf. He's looking forward to speaking to Padraig as well. If you just want to quickly text us on some of the greatest or daftest tips you've had on your golf swing, then do give us a shout. Text 85058. We'll also be looking at a great radio documentary series, or rather drama series, I should say, about the CIA called Central Intelligence. It's a really great series, and we've got the writer of that coming on to talk to us. First, though, let's look at a story we just heard in the news, a review of the way police forces deal with reports of stalking. It's called for significant changes. The report came from the Independent Office for Police Conduct, Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary and the College of Policing. It found clear evidence to support concerns about how the police dealt with reports of stalking. Our correspondent Lucy Manning has been looking at the report.
A coalition of charities led by the Susie Lamplugh Trust submitted a super complaint to police about how stalking was dealt with. They're designed to look at systemic issues rather than individual cases. The subsequent investigation found there were too many occasions when stalking victims weren't protected and risks weren't identified. It discovered issues with police investigations into stalking, concluded the law was confusing, that the police lacked understanding of the scale and types of stalking, and said safeguarding failures were leaving some victims at serious risk. The report sets out immediate steps chief constables should take to improve stalking investigations, and it calls for a change in the law and for stalking protection orders to be simplified. The head of the College of Policing said improvements were needed, and national guidance for police across England and Wales would be strengthened to improve the quality of investigations. But those working with vulnerable women say while the report is welcome, the issues have been known about for years and change has been slow.
Saskia Garner is the head of policy and campaigns at the Susie Lamplugh Trust. Saskia, it's the super complaint made by your trust. Why was that made?
Well, we speak to thousands of victims of stalking every year, as do other services across the National Stalking Consortium. And what we hear from them is that they are being let down by the police, by the criminal justice system as a whole. They're not being believed in many cases. They're not being listened to. Evidence is being dismissed, or stalking is not being recognised. So they might record a crime of malicious communications or harassment. But essentially, they're not getting the justice that they deserve. And in fact, the conviction rate for stalking is less than 2% of reports to police. So we felt compelled to represent their concerns as a super complaint. As we hear this so widely across the country, we strongly suspected these were systemic issues. And that is what this committee has confirmed.
And so what, I mean, it's a bigger question, but what's the key thing that needs to change? Is it the change in the law or the way the current laws are interpreted?
Well, it could be both. Certainly, we absolutely think there need to be mandated training for any police officer dealing with a stalking case by specialist independent stalking experts. We know that in many forces, and this report has confirmed that there are often aren't specialist stalking officers, and that therefore risks are being missed. safeguarding opportunities are not being taken up. We know the use of protective orders, including stalking protection orders, which were brought in specifically to protect victims at the earliest possible stage, as soon after they've reported, aren't being used. And these are all things that are already in place. So we know that there's a lack of training and a lack of understanding across policing. But we also know that there is some confusion about the way that the law is set out. It's different, for example, to the way the law is framed in Northern Ireland and in Scotland. So we agree that there is a review that's needed to look at why it is that cases we believe meet the higher threshold for the greater sentencing aren't often going through as that. The impact on the victim, the psychological impacts aren't necessarily being captured. And we would like to understand the impact of what the changes in the law could mean for victims and ensure that any change would have a positive impact on them.
So how would you hope things change for somebody now or a year or two down the line, hopefully no longer than that, when they report, look, they are being stalked, this person... You might not think they've committed offence, they haven't physically done anything, but they are sort of ruining my life. That's what's difficult to get ahead. On what basis does there need to be a police intervention or a warning? Is that going to become clearer?
Absolutely. I mean, we know from devastating cases like Gracie Spinks and Alice Ruggles, whose families have spoken at length about the fact that they did have the courage to ring the police, which many victim survivors don't, but they actually did. But those risks weren't picked up, even though there were clear red flags around those perpetrators turning up at their homes, escalating in the kinds of communications they were having, the kind of language they were using. In Alice's case, her perpetrator started to leave messages along the lines of, I don't want to kill you, but... And yet this was recorded as a case of harassment. So unfortunately, what often happens is individual incidents are recorded, but the wider pattern that demonstrates that obsession and fixation isn't picked up. So absolutely, as I said, training is needed across all police forces, but we also know that we need to work together as a multi-agency approach. Police forces are championing this in places like the Cheshire Harm Reduction Unit, the Stalking Threat Assessment Centre in London, which our advocates work in, and working together with probation, police officers, healthcare, psychologists and expert advocates can really pick up that risk at the earliest possible opportunity and start to put in place interventions with perpetrators, including orders that restrict their movements and their communications with victims, but also look to break that pattern of fixation and that reoffending longer term.
Okay, thank you. Thanks very much indeed. That was Saskia Gardner from the Susie Lamplew Trust. Let's get into some sport at 13 minutes past 12. Kate Mason joins us. How are you, Kate?
Adrian, yeah, I'm great, thank you. How are you doing?
Yes, good. Now, we find you in... Where are you this week? You're covering the mountain biking, aren't you? Which far-flung mountain are you on?
Yeah, I'm by a lake currently, in Lake Placid. So it's upstate New York, which is... The fall colours are not quite here yet. You know how the leaves famously go into these incredible colours in this part of the world. They're not quite there. But the rain has stopped. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we're going to be doing 2 days of mountain biking and then next weekend into Canada to wrap up the whole season.
Oh, and what kind of sport is available to you outside mountain biking round there? Is there soccer being played, football? What's in season now? Where's the nearest baseball franchise to you there?
Well, last year I went to see Montreal in the major league, in the MLS, not the, is it? You say, yeah. MLS. There's not a lot very conveniently located for specifically where we are. You'd have to have probably a bit of a drive, about 4 hour drive to get to the Buffalo Bills, for example. You've also got the Sabres, is another option for you. That's pre-season going on in the NHL at the moment. So I could potentially go and catch them tomorrow if I was in the evening. It's sort of 7 o'clock they're playing. I think it might be a bit of a stretch after things wrap up here. But yeah, in terms of major franchises, it looks like the Bills really, or if you're going east instead, you could get to Portland and go and see Portland Timbers. But yeah, I think we're in a bit of a gap in those, in terms of those teams. But then again, in the States, you know what it's like. People are happy to drive for miles and miles to get to watch their sport. So I think the Bills are the solution.
Okay, let's get into the football over here. We got Premier League winner, former Scotland captain Colin Hendry with us. Colin, how are you doing?
I'm very well, guys. I'm good. How are you?
Yes, all good. Thank you very much. I mean, we should mention Blackburn doing really well in the Championship.
Yeah, I was at the game on Sunday when they drew with Preston 0-0. A couple of red cards in that game, derby-ish type game as well, but they've had a great start, Blackburn. And I think, if I'm being honest, Adrian, the pessimists were out there to start with. They were quite happy to go along with it's going to be another season of doom and gloom. And listen, I know it's early days, and it's very early days, but they were one of the favourites, I think, to be, say, relegated. You know, they were talking about relegation for the Blackburn Rovers, but Johnny Eustace has done a good job, and so far so good, and the momentum is there with them, and it's good to see.
I just wanted to ask you about the City-Arsenal game, where obviously Arsenal were clinging on to this 2-1 lead through all the second half, down to 10 men. It was attack against defence, desperate rearguard action against one of the finest teams in world football. Have you ever been part of a desperate defensive effort that seemed to go on forever?
Yeah, but yeah. Adrian, we played Blackburn the season we won the Premiership. We played Everton on the Saturday. Now, during the week, I'd been on Scotland duty in Russia. So I'd travelled to Russia. I think we got a draw, took a point in that game, qualifier. We came back on this Saturday. We played Everton at Goodison Park. We were 2-0 up pretty soonish. It went to 2-1. And the second half was like the Alamo. It was a proper rear guard. And I often mention, I do a bit of speaking, a bit of talking, I say to them, that was that week, because on the Tuesday evening after that Saturday, we played QPR at Loftus Road and we won 1-0. So we'd back-to-back win 6 points. That's the weekend I thought that we won the league for Blackburn Rovers. We won the Premiership. But listen, I've been in many, and it was proper 6-yard, 18-yard box, kicking out stuff. And it was just like Saturday with Arsenal. You know, they're down to 10 men. I know that people are talking about the dark arts. I think when they talk about the dark arts, I think they talk about that through the whole of the game or as a generalisation. So when Arsenal, and you've got to credit Mikel Arteta for that as well, as because he stuck it into the lads. You know, he said, "Listen, you've got to play the game. You've got to maximise every opportunity to have every advantage that you can." And that's what they did. And I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I remember. I mean, I seen Ian Wright's comments. Wrighty wasn't too happy with Big Haaland and some of the stuff that went on. But hey, Wrighty was one of the worst. great lad. But tell you what, I played against Arsenal at Ewood Park, and I'd gone up for a header. I think it was, if it was near Wrighty, it might have been Alan Smith. But anyway, I've come down, there's blood everywhere, all over my face. I've done my eye, I've done my nose. And as I managed to get a bit of sight as I'm lying on the ground, who's right over the top of me laughing? Ian Wright. Wright is right on top of me, and I'm thinking, hold on a minute, Wrighty. So I'm listening to what he was saying at the weekend. I get it. I understand what he's saying, but he was as bad as any of them, because you could have done it in our day as well.
They'd held on Arsenal, and then in the 98th minute, you know, this happens.
Shot from Kovacic, that's blocked, and it's smuggled into the net!
And Can you just explain how that feels when you've held on for a whole half and then right at the death it scrambled in?
Well, I've not been in very much of them situations, Adrian, if I'm being honest.
Yeah,
Listen, I still have a game of footy now. You know, I still play a 90 minutes here and there. And, I'm not going to say that the referee goes to 8-9 minutes on top, but it's so destroying. It really, really is so destroying because it's obviously your differences between your 3 points and your 1 point. Okay, it's not a defeat, and Arsenal will be happy that they've gone to the Etihad and not been beaten. Mm. But it's still an absolute kick. You know, it's a tough one to take.
Okay, for reasons that Kate and I will explain shortly, we've got Padraig Harrington on now because we want to ask him something about golf. Yeah, we've got him, I mean, Padraig, we just get you on football first. I mean, when you hear them talking about dark arts, are there dark arts in golf? Obviously, you can't go elbowing each other if you're on the course, but is there anything like that in golf?
There would be if we were playing for fun, for sure, but generally you're meant to let the clubs do the talking. But I won't say this is dark arts, but one of the smartest things I've seen done was last year by Brooks Koepka. So at the Masters, there was a 20-minute delay on the second tee, and he had a big problem with the pace of play after that because everything's so slow. It's like rush hour traffic. Mm-hmm. So he's a fast player. So then he was leading in the PGA in the last group, and he knew he was going to have an issue with pace of play. So he deliberately marked his one-foot putts during the day so that he'd have to come back and knock it in. It was an extra minute a hole or whatever it would take just to slow down his pace of play so that he wasn't always waiting.
Okay, interesting, very interesting. You're a football fan yourself?
I'm a Leeds United fan for my suffering. Right?
How did that come about then?
I have a brother who's 10 years older than me, so he would have followed them in their great days. And he followed Leeds, second oldest followed Everton, third oldest followed Arsenal, and the oldest one hit the hardest, so I followed Leeds.
Mm-hmm. And do you ever look at a team game and think, God, that must be better just to shoulder the pain when you've lost together as a team and to, you know, to celebrate together as a team when you've won. You know, golf is supposed to be a lonely place.
Oh, that is the problem with golf. It is extremely lonely, and players are starting to understand that now. More and more players will rent a house and room with other players at tournaments. You see less of individuals staying in hotel rooms because there is nothing worse than being in a hotel room on your own when things are going badly. You're looking at the four walls, you're overanalyzing everything. So football teams are lucky that they always share. I actually have shared with my caddy on the road for 20 years now.
Oh, really? Twin beds? Or is you like Morecambe and Wise sort of sitting up in bed together?
We do have to explain that at times. You know, we often have to explain that we need two beds. Yes, we get a lot of romantic tables with candles at times when we're out for dinner. But, you know, everybody's understanding the mental pressures off the course. And this is why Europeans have tended to do badly in the US over the years, because they go on their own. They don't have the same social structure. And to be honest, I was just thinking as you were doing the football, saying we miss one of the best moments on the European tour is September, October, when there's Champions League football. We're all away in Europe. We end up in the same pub on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday night, and you'll see 50, 60 of fellow players, caddies in there watching the match. If you go to the States, you mightn't see another player or caddy for the whole week off the golf course. It's just a lonely place when you're not in college sports.
That's so interesting. Now, listen, we need to get onto golf. And, Padraig, in Colin Hendry, we have found the only Scotsman I've ever come across who doesn't play golf. What went wrong, Colin? You must have tried it at some stage.
At a house in the south of France for a while. I tried it there. I tried it in Florida when I took the kids during the close season away. Mm-hmm. I tried it in Spain with the lads on when you get your rest day during pre-season. I've tried it everywhere and I could not get into it at all. So I am purely and simply a four-legged friend type of guy.
Right,
now, if I was leaving the house with my German Shepherd, and he's, where are you going with a bag of sticks, Dad? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? If I was leaving the house with a set of golf clubs, he'd be thinking, this sticks Annie going with me. So to be fair, I tried and tried, but no, couldn't catch it. My son Callum, he has a go. He seems to be a lot more into it than I have ever been and tried.
Okay. Well, listen, just
I'm very paranoid at that. There's a couple of things. To play golf, you need to have time. You need to be rich in time, which ex-footballers and footballers tend to be. Mm-hmm. So generally when sports people don't play golf, it's because they've tried it and they can't get the hang of it. And it's very frustrating because they're good at everything. Okay? And the second one is the opposite. They just don't have the patience for it. So they're okay at the game, but it requires a lot of patience. So the two sides, generally when you see ex-sports people, but then the ones who do take it up become so obsessive about it. It's unbelievable. Yeah.
Okay, the reason we got Podrick on is that I saw this golf tip on, and I sent it to Kate, and Kate felt the same way about it. How do we describe it, Kate? Normally, when you play golf, you plant your 2 feet. All the coaches say, you know, your 2 feet have got to be on the ground as you address the ball, swing back and go through it. But Kate, Podrick advises something different.
Yeah, well, you seem to be talking about how you could kind of move like as if you were throwing, which we thought was pretty interesting in terms of moving one of your feet. And it's give yourself a bit of momentum.
We can use this is the clip. I think this is courtesy of the PGA, because I think it was on their website.
They copied up.
Okay, let's have a quick listen.
So what I would say to all amateurs, to step and hit shots, so... And as you see, it's about here that the step forward starts, so you get left early. You should be able to do that and not feel like it's really alien or uncomfortable. So you've got to practice it until that feels pretty normal to you. What you will find, especially if you were an athlete as a kid, you know, if you played sports, you will find that that movement will free you up, will give you a lot more of the separation that we talk about, will get you left like they all talk about.
I mean, Patrick, I could introduce you to golf teachers who would go faint and have to sit down at the very thought of taking a step forward as you go. But I really like the idea of it.
No, I guarantee you, the golf teachers, you're talking about 20 handicappers giving you advice on the weekend. So the worst things you can do in golf is keep your feet still, keep your head down, swing slowly, and try and open up at impact. Those are the four worst things, and yet they're the four most common pieces of advice you see given by amateurs to other amateurs. So you never want to keep your head down. You don't want to keep it still. You never want to keep your feet still, planted. You never want to swing slowly. You've got to swing pretty aggressively at the golf ball, and you've got to move. Now, as regards the step, you should be moving your feet. Basically, I'll describe it because we're talking football. So if you were throwing the ball in from the sideline and you planted your feet, you might throw 15 yards. If you wanted to throw it 30 yards, you'd run up, step, and
or
throw.
Or you're skimming a stone, or throwing a baseball. You would naturally move your front foot forward, wouldn't you?
Everything is about moving the front foot, moving into your left side, planting, and exploding up. Now, the popping up bit, you'll recognize this. How many times does a beginner come to the game and they go to hit it first time and they fresh air and the person will say, oh, you got to keep your feet ground and you got to keep your head down. That's the first thing.
Keep your head still.
The popping up is the speed in the swing. You've got to pop up to hit the golf ball. Now, as a beginner, you haven't got the coordination. You'll probably end up popping up 6-8 inches before the ball and miss it. Whereas by stepping into the ball, you're delaying that acceleration up to, which gives the speed, and you're also moved the spot further left, so you're going to time it. So it's the same as you just said. If you were going to swing an axe into a tree sideways, if you're going to throw a ball to your dog, do it in a golf posture, and I guarantee you will not be able to throw any tennis ball 10 yards, 15 yards if you keep both feet in the ground. Whereas if you wanted to throw it, you'd step left and release it. It's natural. It's what we all do.
So are you saying most people are doing it? It's just kind of imperceptible in terms of the foot moving like that.
Professional golfers are all doing it. Yes. Every one of them is doing it. But because of coordination, professional golfers look like they're still, look like their head is still, and look like they're swinging smooth. But they're not doing any of those. That's coordination. That's a beautiful move. The better the coordination, the less it looks like it's off.
Someone else I sent it to was John John Robbins, and my colleague John, very keen golfer. That step that you've seen, what did you make of it? Have you been stepping yourself, John?
Hello, Pádraig. John Robbins here. 14.8 handicap. got down to 12.1 a couple of years ago after pretty empty patch in my life. I agree with some elements of what Pádraig's saying. You know, I can't say that I'm a major winner, so I'm not bringing that kind of expertise to the table. But I'm interested in the whole idea of amateurs, 20 handicappers, getting tips from YouTube videos, because you can end up in a complete mess without someone to sort of talk you through it in real time. But my question for Pádraig with that step video would be, how do you avoid then my miss with my driver is ending up with my weight on my front foot? So my driver head is coming down on the ball and I'm closing the face and then it pops up really high, because you don't actually want to be leaning forward, do you?
You do. You actually want to be on your left side. So just as regards the YouTube, or not the YouTube, but the social media tips, they're generally aimed at elite players. So,
yes.
You know, and I would teach a teenager different. I would tell him to rotate the hell out of it, because he will learn to speed up his arms and keep up. Mm-hmm. No amateur who's playing once a week, once a month is going to be able to do that. If you spin, your arms are going to get stuck behind you, which is terrible. Mm-hmm. So as regards... for you, I'd have to see your swing, but I think what you're telling me is unlikely beautiful. That you're too far left.
Mm-hmm. I'm a left-handed golfer, so I'm just switching it around in my head. But my coach always says, keep your weight in your left pocket for me as a left-hander on the drive, because
does he tell you to lift your front foot up?
Well, Kyle Berkshire almost jumps off the floor when he's hitting his drives, but that would be mad for me to try and copy that.
Why?
Because I'm 42 and not strong.
And he's shy.
You might twist an angle on when you land.
You've got to understand, you're going to hurt your back more and neck more by trying to stay still rather than moving. Because movement, the right movement. So if you turned around to me and said you have a sore lower back, I would tell you to step over your left foot with your left hand. I would tell you to step over your lead foot with your back foot after you hit the ball. So walk after it. The old Gary Player trick. Because that's stopping you getting stuck into your lower back. So move.
And we've got to make this meeting of minds happen.
If
you've got a sore neck, release your head. Do an
if you've got a sore heart.
Watch my YouTube videos.
Do you offer relationship advice?
I've got a question for Pádraig, Adrian, which I need recorded for posterity.
Go on.
I've just come back from a yearly golf trip I go on to Portugal with 27 other guys, and we play Ryder Cup format each year. So I've been going 10 years. We're a couple of years off for COVID. But my playing record, Pádraig, is 20 wins, 2 losses, 2 halves. Have you ever heard in the history of all golf of a better match play record than 22 and 2?
I'm sure the stats guys will find one, but I'd pick you if I was captain again.
Wow. That's up. You've given us a good show now.
Bring those 14 shots. It's sounding like you're a bit of a bandit.
Okay.
Well, one of the guys is off 52 shots.
Okay.
I'm not sure I'm that much.
We'll have to move on. Anton de Beck's just got a new golf podcast.
A golf podcast. No,
but anyway, he asked me who my favourite golfer was, and I did say, honestly, Pádraig Harrington. I just one of the few who seems to be actually enjoying yourself out there.
Why didn't you say John Robbins, did you? Because
he hasn't won a major. That's
why didn't
why.
You say listen to Beef's Golf Club with John Robbins sometimes?
Oh, or watch Bad Golf with John Robbins and Alex Horn. Call him.
I haven't been invited on his podcast, so we can lump it until John invites me. Listen, thanks very much, Pádraig. Thank you very much indeed for that. I can't wait to get on the range and start stepping for all I'm worth.
You'll find them all on Paddy's Golf Tips on YouTube, and they'll be explained better. Okay.
And that is a really good channel. I have been watching Pádraig's tips, and they are fantastic.
Okay.
I would ask you to trust me.
You sounded like a hypnotist then, the way you said that.
Do it, and you'll get better.
Okay.
Don't be afraid. You like. I'll just get last tip, okay? Mm-hmm. If you want to hit the ball straight, okay, and I think a lot of people do, you've got to hit big hooks and big slices when you're on the range, because nobody really knows what a degree open or a degree closed is. But you can figure out what 10 degrees open and 10 degrees closed is. So do the big exaggerations until you understand them.
Yeah.
And then you will be able to reduce the size of the miss. So go with big hooks and big slices.
Go onto the driving range and just hit a whole load of terrible balls. Do you know how intimidating it is sometimes turning up to some of these driving ranges? Everyone looking at you thinking you shouldn't be here and you look terrible. You
really?
Slicing it all over the place.
No, that's in your head. Okay? That is in your head. Okay. There are terrible people in driving ranges and there's great people. Okay. That is in your head.
Okay.
Don't
worry.
But my handicap
My handicap has dropped by about 10. Absolutely. I want to live with him. Thank you. Look, thanks all very much. Ellis and John are coming up next. Thanks to Padraig Harrington. Thanks to Colin Hendry for coming on. And Kate, have a great weekend up there by Lake Placid. Let's get the news and sport.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The 5 Live News with Dina Campbell. Two 13-year-old boys will serve a minimum of 8 years and 6 months in prison for the murder of 19-year-old Sean Cesarhai with a machete. They were both aged just 12 years old when they killed Mr. Cesarhai in a Wolverhampton park last year. The conviction means the pair have become Britain's youngest knife murderers. The BBC has learned that the General Medical Council, which regulates doctors in the UK, refused in 2017 to investigate alleged medical malpractice at Harrods. A complaint was made by a woman who underwent an intimate examination while applying for a job at the department store in 2008, when it was owned by Mohammed Al-Fayed. The GMC says it will carefully assess any new complaints. 32-year-old Kieran Usher from Sunderland, who was the first person to admit a riot charge relating to the recent nationwide disorder, has been jailed for 4 years and 4 months. His case relied on CCTV, which captured him donning a face covering before encouraging others to participate in violence. Mike McCarthy is here with your sport.
Well, no play at Lord's presently, with England needing to beat Australia in the fourth one-day international to keep the series alive. Ellie Oldroyd is there at Lord's for us. What hope can you offer, Ellie?
Well, it does look as if it's a little bit clearer overhead, but we've had quite a lot of rain in the last hour or so. We should be getting underway now, but we haven't had the toss yet. The ground staff working hard to clear the water off the covers, but the cover's firmly on at the moment. The forecast is that it will brighten up a little bit later, so we're hopeful that we will get some play a bit later on.
Well, when there is play, there's commentary on Five Sports Extra through the day as well. Manchester City have been drawn with the holders Barcelona in the group stage of the Women's Champions League. Meanwhile, Chelsea will play Celtic, who've reached the group stage for the very first time. They're in the same group as Real Madrid as well. Arsenal, meanwhile, have been drawn in the same group as Bayern Munich and Juventus. It's the first time three English clubs have featured in the group stage of the competition in its current format. Liverpool boss Arne Slot says he expects goalkeeper Alisson to be fit for tomorrow's trip to Wolves. He missed their last two matches through injury. A toe issue, though, looks to like it'll prevent Alexander Isak from being available for Newcastle when they host Manchester City. Eddie Howe's side got a free week, but Isak's not been able to recover the extra training due to the postponed EFL Cup game at AFC Wimbledon, which saw flooding cause significant damage to the League Two side's pitch. A crowdfunding page has already raised £100,000 to help repair the damage.
That's where the football community does so well for each other, because that support is vital. I mean, you look at the pitch there, it looked in a really bad way. Had no idea until sort of minutes before my press conference of the situation. We wish them well and we hope their pitch gets back working very soon.
And the man known as the voice of snooker, Clive Everton, has died at the age of 87. Everton covered the sport on BBC TV for more than 30 years. Former world champion Sean Murphy called him snooker broadcasting royalty. That is the latest from BBC Sport.
You've probably got a list of things your child needs for uni. Pans, cutlery, sheets, duvet, towels, you know. But this is a little reminder that they'll also need a TV licence to be covered to watch all the TV channels, live TV on streaming services and BBC iPlayer. On the downside, it's one more thing on your list. On the upside, you can continue to enjoy your favourite shows together on the family group chat. And they won't be bringing it home to be washed either. To find out more, search TV licence uni.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network.
Charles on Friday.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
As you heard in the sport there, Clive Everton has died at the age of 87. Long-time BBC snooker commentator, a big figure in the sport. I've got to tell you, he's a big figure in my life. As he's got five kids, four daughters, a son as Clive, and I went to school with all of them. They live just round the corner from me, and they're all lovely people. And Clive was fantastic to me when I was a kid, and just talking about wanting to get into journalism. And I saw him relatively recently. It was always lovely to see him. So I'm delighted that Dennis Taylor is coming on shortly to pay tribute to Clive. It's just coming up to 20 to 1. Two boys have been sentenced for the murder of Sean Cesarhigh in Wolverhampton last year. The boys can't be named. They're believed to be the youngest convicted of the crime of murder since Jane Bulger's killers were detained in 93. Our reporter Navtesh Shahar was outside Wolverhampton Crown Court.
So we just heard there a moment ago from Chief Inspector Kim Maddell from West Midlands Police. She described what happened to Sean as horrifying, as shocking, and those comments followed the sentencing by the judge a few moments ago of Sean Cesarhigh's two killers, who were 12 years old at the time of the killing in November last year and who are now 13 years old. They are believed to be Britain's youngest knife murderers, the youngest murderers since the killing of James Bulger in 1993. In her comments, when she was sentencing the two boys a few moments ago, Judge Justice Tipples said that she started off by thinking about Sean and his family, that he was loved by his family, and that the sentence will not comfort them, but it will bring the legal process to a close.
Chief Superintendent Kim Maddell from West Midlands Police.
Sean was only 19 when his life was taken at the hands of two boys, then aged just 12, who had armed themselves with a machete. That reality has had a huge impact on us all. It is both shocking and saddening. The impact of knife crime is devastating, no matter where you live in the country. This is an issue that affects us all. Much work has been done, and we have had successes in some areas. However, this is clearly not enough. We are listening to families affected by knife crime and acting on their feedback to see what more we can do with partners to stop the devastation caused by knife crime. Our responsibility is to work together with partners to understand why children and young people think it is okay to carry weapons and take further action to stop this extremely dangerous behaviour. Our work will not stop, and any death or injury as a result of knife crime will never be acceptable. Thank you.
In her sentencing remarks, the judge, Mrs. Justice Tipple, said you had to consider the boys as individuals but decided on the same minimum term for both.
As the defendants were 14 or under at the date of the offence, the starting point is 13 years. The starting point reflects the seriousness of the offence. I then have to approach the task of setting the minimum term by looking carefully at each defendant on an individual basis, both in terms of what they did, together with the information I have about them as people, their backgrounds and experiences.
So, Mrs. Justice Tipples at Wolverhampton Crown Court. Just coming up to 12:45. It's this time when we normally recommend something to watch on one of the free-to-air streaming services. Today, something to listen to. It's on BBC Sound. It's called Central Intelligence, and it stars Kim Cattrall and Ed Harris. It tells the story of Eloise Page, a story told through her eyes, a trailblazer in the CIA, and it kind of tells the story of the CIA over the years. It's really brilliant piece of work. Here we can hear Eloise introducing herself, and at the time she's in the precursor of the CIA, and they're talking about a letter that they'd found in Hitler's bunker in a safe that was obviously in some kind of code which they couldn't quite crack.
Richard visited the analytics division, which is where I'm putting myself into the story.
Miss Page?
Yes, Mr. Helms?
That's me. I am Miss Eloise Page. I am a single, polite, patriotic, naive, a Christian southerner, already involved in operations having joined the OSS in 1943.
What do you think? Have you had time to examine Gellin's letter?
Well, the signature's genuine, so it is from General Gellin.
So how can we figure out what he's saying? Have you tried X-rays? Infrared?
Yes, Mr. Helms.
Well, it can't just be a simple communication. Why would Hitler keep something like that in his personal safe?
I agree.
Any other ideas?
Well, see the last period? It's lighter and just a little smudged. I did wonder if that was more than just the ribbon running dry.
Oh, my God. Magnify it.
What a fabulous idea.
You already have.
Yeah.
And there was a long, important list of names that she uncovered with that magnification. Greg Hadrick, Australian screenwriter, wrote the series along with Jeremy Fox. Here's how Greg came across Eloise Page in her story.
When I was first doing the initial research into this, before I realised how big it would all become, you find, in particular, the 50th anniversary in 1997, and the CIA had a thing called Trailblazers, and I sort of started there, and Richard Helms was one of them. And Eloise Page was listed as one of the Trailblazers, and I thought, oh, that's really interesting that there was a female Trailblazer dating right back to day one of the CIA in 1947. And then you trawl through all the sources you can find on the internet and the various published books, etc., and you realise there is so little about her. So here is a woman who worked with Bill Donovan and the OSS in World War II, who stayed in American intelligence, joined the CIA on day one. You know very little about her, and yet she's referred to as probably number three in the director of operations by the 1960s. And in 1978, she's the first woman to become a female chief of station in a foreign country. That cannot happen without, I don't think, without her being fairly deeply involved in the director of operations and what they were doing through the 40s and 50s. And yet she's barely mentioned. But her reputation, her nickname was the Iron Butterfly, and her reputation was that she had a spine of steel. And in an era when they were sort of cowboys a little bit, and it was a very action-adventure, pale, male and Yale type of environment, and she was the one who was known to be able to keep them all in line and put them all in line. So although I knew very few details, she was someone who fascinated me in terms of being able to have a POV if we wanted to fictionalise this story.
So you essentially tell the story through of the whole sort of history of the CIA in the second half of the last century through Eloise's eyes. And the clip we just heard, she finds that they find a letter in a safe in Hitler's bunker, and they can't understand why the letter is in the safe. And then she, as we just heard, magnifies it. And on there's a list of names of German spies or Russian anti-communist Russians who would agree to spy for Germany, who are there in Russia and all over Eastern Europe. So obviously they're thinking, oh, we could get these people to work for us now. They were working for Germany, but as they're anti-communist, they can work for the CIA now. But this leads to the following exchange, because Alan Dulles, who went on to become, you know, one of the most important figures in the history of the CIA, has other ideas what you could do with that list of names. Let's have a listen.
We could exploit these names to show Truman what we can do with valuable intelligence.
Exploit?
Let the Russians know we do, in fact, have a list of Gellin's recruits in our possession, which, of course, they'd kill for.
Or give us something valuable in return.
You'd give up the only spies we've got behind Eastern Europe?
Not all. We'd call it Gellin's complete list, but maybe make it 30 or 40.
This is insane. We'd still be signing all their death warrants.
We'd be showing Truman how creative we are.
And so it's a pawn sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, you could call it that.
Fair enough.
So, I mean, that gets to the dirty business of espionage and just signing the death warrants of these people. I mean, it neatly gets to the crux of what a sordid business it is, but without that kind of stinking thinking and ruthless interplay, there is no intelligence, is there?
No, there's always, and there's a later quote from Bettle Smith where he says, and he's surprised by that attitude a little bit from a military man, and just says, you've got to check your morals at the door, but you better not forget where you put them. And that's been the history of intelligence for a long time, particularly with field agents. And it is a dark business. But sometimes, you know, that's what they have to do to get the intelligence they need to find. They don't have to do it all the time. And in fact, as you probably know, in the end, they couldn't do a deal with the Russians on that instance.
To what extent do you know whether that's actually sort of how it happened? To what extent is this sort of, I don't know, a true story based on a true story, based loosely on a true story? You know, how accurate are your sources, and how important is it to you that it's actually bang on accurate?
I was always careful, as much as I could be, and you never can be with some of these sources, that the line of general truth running through the show is accurate. The line of specific truth can be accurate and may not be, and that's part of the reason why I've constructed it as Eloise's memory. It's a sort of, because the conceit is that it's her memorial reconstruction. Now, in the passages you just played, we know that Richard Helms did go to the Führer bunker and did go to the Chancellery, and we know that the Russian soldiers let him in and let him walk in and wander around. He did pick up the card of Hitler's stationery from the Chancellery and send it back to Dennis. We do know that they also were looking for Reinhard Gehlen, and they couldn't find him at that point of time. There's, at that same time, there is a story that a list of agents was in Alan Dulles' hand, and he did try to use that to create contacts with what the KGB was then called. It's changed names several times.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether it was the list from the Chancellery and from the Führer bunker that Alan Dulles used, I was never able to put those two together. I did for dramatic purposes, but the different bits are accurate. And he did try to do a deal with the Russians, and they wouldn't do a deal, and it was basically the last time the KGB and the CIA for years ever came close to exchanging contact. So there's three or four separate bits of specific truth there, and joining the dots to connect them into a story, there's a couple of bits where I've made a jump.
That's interesting. And we should say Kim Cattrall, we won't come as a surprise to anyone, he's absolutely brilliant in this, isn't she?
Fabulous, yeah. And it did, we knew from the beginning, because Eloise's voice connects everything, that it had to be a, you know, a great actress to do that. And we were so lucky that Kim said yes.
Now, Eloise's take on it is, it's not so much cynical, but it's sort of sardonic. It's kind of a warts and all, say, look, nobody was really proud of this, etc. Now, to what extent do you know if that was her persona? If this was her attitude to the activities of the CIA?
There's a little bit of extrapolation there. Well, quite a bit, really. What I was able to discover was that she certainly did not buy into the craziest ideas that the blokes came up with and kept on bringing them back into line, that she did value, like Richard Helms, valued intelligence collection above covert action, which they always thought was, you know, a vast expense of money for what it actually brought back. So piecing those two together, you know, I sort of assumed that the way the men behaved through the 40s and 50s in particular under Alan Dulles was something that she would have been a little bit lofty about. And part of it goes to, there was a thing called the Petticoat Panel, which actually isn't in the show. I wish I could have put it in the show. The Petticoat Panel was a panel of the women in the CIA in 1953 after Alan Dulles became director to examine the position of women in the CIA. And they were looking for, you know, a woman to be in charge of that panel. And they sort of didn't want to make Eloise in charge because they thought she would be too strong and a little too bold.
Yeah.
And
but that would be a typical view of a man at the time, wouldn't it? Who, you know, any woman who spoke up and went beyond typing things up would probably be regarded as bullshit, which is quite rich coming from some of the men running the CIA at the time.
It is. But that's why I felt that she, looking back, would have that opinion of them.
Really, really fantastic work. That was the screenwriter Greg Hadrick, and do look up Central Intelligence on BBC Sounds. Now, some sad news today. Tributes are pouring in for Clive Everton, known as the voice of snookers, died at the age of 87. He worked for the BBC for more than 30 years, from the 70s onwards, also one of the most read and respected writers on the sport as well. Called so many of the big moments in snooker, countless world championship finals. This one in 98, for example.
The defending champion, Ken Doherty, by 18 frames to 12 to win the Embassy World Championship.
One man who was commented on by Clive and shared the commentary box room as well is the 1985 world champion Dennis Taylor. Thanks very much for coming on, Dennis. I don't know if you heard earlier, I happen to know Clive really well because I went to school with all his kids and he lived round the corner from me. And he was just such a great guy to know.
He was a fantastic person, was Clive. I first met Clive, I can't believe it, it's 58 years ago. I won the British Junior Billiards Championship and Clive presented the prize, the trophy, to me. And then we've known each other since then. And as you say, I have lots of wonderful memories with Clive in the commentary box and learned quite a lot from him as well. He just was through and through a real snooker person, but as you say, a terrific fellow as well, but a wonderful, wonderful commentator.
Mm-hmm. I remember speaking to him at the Crucible once, and he said, Adrian, it's a marathon of the mind, the World Championship. You know, there's a lot of snooker played. It's a long, long commentary stint.
Yeah, because you do three sessions a day, and it did take it out of you, especially the World Championship, because it was all live, or most of it was live. We loved it, and Clive, you know, he kept going, Clive, until I think Clive was still into his 80s, so, you know, he was a remarkable person. And mind you, it takes me back to the 90s. I don't know whether you remember, Adrian, when we were in the commentary box together at the UK Championship, and it was live. And luckily for Clive, I had a tie on that day because, you know, he was a perfectionist. He didn't like making a mistake. And he made a mistake on the scores about how many snookers was needed. And I sort of laughingly, he said three snookers first was needed. Then he said one snooker. And I laughing said, I think you should try two snookers, Clive. And Clive, he put the microphone down. Now, why they put casters on the chairs in the commentary box, I'll never know, because we had to climb up a ladder to get into the commentary box. And Clive, he said, my head's in a jam jar today, and he pushed backwards, and he was going out of the commentary box, you know, and it was about a 15-foot drop, and he spotted my tie, he grabbed hold of my tie, and it saved him from flying out of the commentary box, and it was all live on TV, you could hear what was happening, the players, the cameramen were all looking around, and they had to cut my tie off me. He pulled it that tight, but luckily it stopped him from going out of the commentary box, but yeah, some wonderful memories. And I remember in Canada, we went to he commentated when I beat Steve in the Canadian Masters. Some wonderful commentary. I've got the clips of that as well still. Yeah.
I mean, the lesson I took from him, having seen him recently, it's very unwell, and I just stuck my head in the window as I walked past his house, and he was sitting in front of the telly watching the tennis, I think, and he was just still full of enthusiasm. His eyes alight with sport and watching it and loving it and totally engaged in it. And there's so many people who get jaded, you know, with in our business with what they do with the sport, but I didn't see any sign of it with him.
he never ever did. You know, I hadn't seen Clive for, I know he was ill for quite some time now, but I hadn't seen him for quite a few years, since his last commentary, really. But he was so full of enthusiasm, and it showed. It showed in his commentary, listening to him. But he had a great way with words, did Clive, obviously being a journalist, but he was wonderful the way he used the words. And, I mean, Ted Lowe was will always be the voice of snooker for me, but Clive took over from Ted Lowe, and he certainly was the voice of snooker. Mm. And people loved these loved the way he put it over and the way he portrayed it. But he, you know, he had snooker scene going from way back, the early days. And as I say, he was a snooker man through and through, and loved the game. Absolutely loved the game.
Dennis, thank you very much indeed. Dennis Taylor playing tribute to Clive Everton, the great snooker commentator and great person who's died at the age of 87. Thanks very much for your company today. Have an enjoyable Friday afternoon and a great weekend.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The 5 Live News with Dina Campbell. Two boys have been sentenced to life with a minimum term of 8.5 years for murdering a teenager with a machete. The pair, who can't be named, were just 12 when they attacked Sean Sisahai in a park in Wolverhampton in November last year. They're the UK's youngest knife murderers. Chief Superintendent Kim Maddill from West Midlands Police spoke outside Nottingham Crown Court.
The impact of knife crime is devastating, no matter where you live in the country. This is an issue that affects us all. Much work has been done, and we have had successes in some areas. However, this is clearly not enough.
The BBC has learned that the General Medical Council, which regulates doctors in the UK, refused in 2017 to investigate alleged medical malpractice at Harrods. A complaint was made by a woman who underwent an intimate examination while applying for a job at the department store in 2008 when it was owned by Mohammed Al-Fayed, who's been accused of rape and sexual assault. The UK has asked commercial airlines to lay on extra flights out of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, to help British nationals leave the country. Sir Keir Starmer has urged them to go because of the fighting between Hezbollah and Israel. A major review of the way police forces in England and Wales deal with reports of stalking has called for significant changes. The report, written by the Independent Office for Police Conduct, Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary and the College of Policing, warned that many victims were not being protected. Here's our special correspondent, Lucy Manning.
The review of how stalking is treated by police was triggered by a super complaint from a coalition of charities. It found there were too many occasions when stalking victims weren't protected. It concluded the law was confusing, that officers lacked understanding of the scale and types of stalking, and said safeguarding failures were leaving some victims at serious risk. The report sets out immediate steps to improve stalking investigations and calls for a change in the law. The head of the College of Policing said improvements were needed and national guidance for police across England and Wales would be strengthened.